medieval stories really introduced him to Jesus.
But he's so gracious and affable and humorous that you don't realize that he's bludgeoning you.
And you are two-thirds, three-quarters of the way through that book, and like, man, he's going to talk me into being an atheist. Well, in a world first broadcasting that we have a three-person studio going on. Well, I suppose we did this for the promo, didn't we?
I think we did.
History is not even being made.
It was awesome.
On the As of Yet to Be Named podcast, which is the de facto name of this podcast, we are having a discussion panel on the one, the only C.S. Lewis.
Yeah.
My good friend Clive Staples, Dr. Wade Mobley, president of the schools. Maddie Trost, I had to check myself because I almost went Grevin on that one. another co-host of mine.
Yep.
And the three of us are here. Wade, you are our resident philosopher.
Which is the scariest thing. Yeah. But it's true.
It is.
It's scary.
And Maddie, you are the teacher of record on a class called C.S.
Lewis
and Friends.
That's right.
And C.S. Lewis plays a massive role in both my Christian thought and apologetics classes. Mm-hmm. And there is so much crossover to what he wrote for our application. And that goes hand in hand with all sorts of misunderstandings about who C.S. Lewis was and what he did. So that's what we're going to talk about C.S. Lewis. So what do you guys got for me? I'm going to throw it out.
Well, the first thing is he's not Winston Churchill or J.R.R. Tolkien. So commonly confused.
Yeah. Important to note, I just read an article over the summer of how violently he was rejected by Wheaton College.
Oh,
when he was alive, he was a threat because they thought he was being too modernist.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Yeah.
That was not in the pre-show conversation.
No, it wasn't. This is part of having a conversation.
One of the great C.S. Lewis scholars, what was his name? Brent Olson had him. Oh, this is terrible for... I'm sorry, gentle listener. This is already, we're going to have to edit this, but Clive Kilby.
Yep.
Clyde Kilby. That's what it was.
And that's the name of the collection, or the chair at Wheaton right now. It's the Kilby Chair of C.S. Lewis Studies.
They went from, we don't like C.S. Lewis, to have a chair.
Maybe name a chair.
Yeah, okay. and we own his library.
Right.
Okay.
Go big or go home.
Mm-hmm. So C.S. Lewis, early 20th century author. His mom dies. When he was just a child, he grows up with, it's kind of weird. It's like all British children of that age are already, go to boarding school, already have an estranged relationship with their father. So once you say like he had a normal childhood, but he's profoundly affected by not having a mother. He goes to boarding school. And the interesting thing, he writes that I acquired atheism at boarding school. What does that mean?
Well, atheists aren't born, they're made.
Yeah.
It takes a lot of education to make an atheist.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's your first real kind of evidence of the Darwinian shift in philosophy, is that now atheism is the common posture of the European West.
Yeah.
So late 19th century Romanticism, and for us it was a little bit later. And so that was very much coloring the educational experiences of the upper class of British society. And in Britain, at least at the time, public school means private school.
Yeah.
So it's very confusing.
Backwards and upside down. Yep. So he's formed into atheism in a boarding school in England and shipped off like just about every male in Europe at the time to World War I, mm-hmm. Is injured and deeply affected by his experiences of World War I. So probably that's our kind of our smoking gun, open door kind of moment. There's no conversion. There's no foxhole conversion for him. But he's rattled, goes back, gets his credentials as a scholar and as a college professor. I think one of the first people never really considered this is C.S. Lewis was a world-class scholar of medieval literature.
Oh, yeah. Yes.
And I think that medieval stories really introduced him to Jesus. One of the really interesting things about his story that I find so fascinating is that he was extremely well-read. Even before World War I, he grew up in a very well-read household. A lot of the inklings were well-read. If you want your kids to succeed, read to your kids. That's the story behind the Inklings, I think.
Yeah.
But if you want them to be good thinkers, I think you read to them. But there's this really fascinating story that Lewis tells about himself, is that he was at the train station, and he picks up this book by George MacDonald. And he says before he even acknowledges, you know, Jesus Christ as his savior, his imagination is baptized by this story. One of my favorite elements of that is that stories, even when we're not necessarily expecting Jesus to pop up into these fantastic stories of fiction, that Lewis really is introduced to Jesus through that fantastical story.
Now, there's a couple of things there. MacDonald does not nearly have the reputation that C.S. Lewis does. I've never read MacDonald. I know what he did.
You've been to MacDonald.
I've been to, and I've sung old MacDonald.
Yeah. But, different guy.
Yeah. Yeah.
But all the Inklings point to him as their literary father.
And matter of fact, in MacDonald's like philosophy of writing, he writes about this term mythopoeia, which is like the hallmark of Lewis and Tolkien's fantasy, of this idea of taking ideas from the past, these images from the past, and writing them into because common stories all tell about the larger story of Jesus Christ. So really cool when you're creating your myth making, when you're creating the world that your stories are going to be a part of, MacDonald really believed that story can echo the story of Jesus Christ, the ultimate truth.
So it's MacDonald who forms Tolkien's theology of the true myth.
Yep.
And then this is where a lot of people think C.S. Lewis is famous for being C.S. Lewis, but C.S. Lewis is a world-class scholar of medieval literature, and he's at Oxford, and he meets J.R.R. Tolkien, who, you know, writes The Lord of the Rings, writes The Hobbit, has his own following, and it's Tolkien who presents to Lewis the idea of the true myth.
Yeah.
And this is finally what pulls C.S. Lewis back into Christianity. And so you just think of these minds who are living together in community at Oxford in the 30s and the 40s, and they're forming each other. Lewis edits The Lord of the Rings. Tolkien bases ideas off of Narnia. They're bouncing things back and forth. And what I love about these guys is what we've lost in Christianity today is this idea of the sanctified imagination.
Mm-hmm.
Going in that direction. And then it's C.S. Lewis who gets called to the front lines of World War II, not in combat, but as a Christian apologist. And this kind of gets back into your territory, Wade, because you're a Churchill guy.
I really am. But okay, so I met C.S. Lewis through Churchill.
Did you really?
Yeah.
Okay. That's funny.
So, all right, so I was I'm not sure if we want to get into this. This is post-Habsburg Europe.
Yeah.
So Linda Iverson, shout out, high school history teacher, plops down on my desk Margaret Truman's biography of her dad in sophomore U.S. history class. Everybody else was doing these, 150-pager, whatever. Here's this chunk. This is for you. So she wanted me to have a bigger challenge. And so I didn't know any better. I should have filed a grievance, right? Why are you being so hard on me? But instead, I read the book. And through Truman, met everybody from World War II. And it was just fascinating to me. The whole Hitler question, everybody goes, ad Hitlerum. Yeah. So how could Hitler exist? And then you dive into this and you start to realize, if it wouldn't have been Hitler, it would have been somebody else. This was inevitable because of the philosophy, what was going on, and really Northeast United States is where it grew. So you read all about this and you just fall in love with the post-Habsburg world order and meet all these people. So in my bookshelves, you got all kinds of Churchill, all kinds of, De Gaulle and Roosevelt and Truman. For some reason, I love Truman. And anyway, but I do. So through the midst of this is how do you survive the Blitz, the Battle of London? Well, you have an Oxford Don go on,
talking about
Roosevelt's,
true things.
So Roosevelt's fireside chats. Churchill was talking about the transcendent things.
Yeah.
Those became part of Mere Christianity, the broadcast talks.
Lewis's talks.
Yeah, Lewis's talks.
Yeah.
So they, Churchill asking me that. Churchill, not a Christian.
Yeah.
I remember my son asking me years ago, what's the first thing you're going to ask Winston Churchill when you get to heaven? And I said, well, I don't think you'll be there. And he looked at me like, you have odd ways to pick your heroes. And I don't claim to be a Churchill, but I'm certainly no Chamberlain. So it's just fascinating stuff. And that's how I met C.S. Lewis.
Yeah.
So it's if you haven't read Mere Christianity, it's really readable.
It's so good.
And, there's tons of other things to read. He's written hundreds of essays that I haven't read. And I think his mastery of the essay form is probably better than anything else he does. It's master. You don't realize he is beating you up rhetorically, but he's so gracious and affable and humorous that you don't realize that he's bludgeoning you. Pretty cool.
And his ability to think and reason through issues where you kind of have talking heads today who, because of their position of fame, try to present themselves on experts on everything.
Hmm.
And Lewis approaches all of the things he comments on from a position of humility, but because he's got the skill of reason so almost down to a science, is that, like, I want to hear what he has to say on these topics. Every time I've read, just that kind of, like, B-side material that Lewis has that's not popular, you're like, oh, man, this is great. It's really useful. And that's who C.S. Lewis kind of ends up being. He marries late in life. His marriage to Joy Davidson gives him all sorts of materials to comment on the human condition, both good and very sad. In fact, we use A Grief Observed, which is his kind of mementos and laments after her death. That's one of our textbooks for pastoral counseling in the seminary.
Yeah.
And just an idea of how to process through
grief. Do you do anything with problem of pain in that? Yeah, I used to have students do problem of pain and grief observed and compare contrast, because it was problem of pain was early in his career, pre-marriage, and then the grief observed is more affectatious.
Yeah, it's raw.
And I think really I told you my copy of Problem of Pain I stole from the library at Faith Lutheran Brock. Nobody's reading it. Anyway, it was great. Yeah, it's really.
What's the interest on those library fees?
Yeah, I'm not sure. Easier just to give them a book, but. The idea of here this is philosophically, which is kind of the way I look at those difficult questions. But in the moment of it, it just hurts.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what you get in the grief observed.
Yep.
And his questions about the existence of God in A Grief Observed are right there. They take you right to the issue. And man, you are 2/3, 3/4 of the way through that book, and like, man, he's going to talk me into being an atheist.
Mm-hmm.
You're just miserable. And then he comes right out of it at the end, and it's such a glorious ending to point, well, God knows what he's doing, and he has his reasons, and his response of faith is just, it's great.
So I once read an essay. It wasn't an essay. It was a commentary by an atheist who said that he did not think C.S. Lewis was ever truly an atheist. Because no true atheist would come to the conclusions that he did. So this must have been his upbringing. Which is an example
of... the atheist eternal security argument?
Oh, yeah. This is like Calvinism for atheists.
Sure. Yeah.
And it's an example. That's actually an example of what he calls... Well, in the third episode, we'll talk about bulverism.
Bulverism. Okay. So that's a term for Luke to flash up on the screen.
That's a tease.
Yeah. Luke has to learn how to spell it now. What
about bulverism? Bulverism. It's not a real word. He would occasionally make stuff up because he was writing to a contemporary art. So he was trying to not offend people. You're like, sometimes we will have a conversation without using names or addresses or zip codes. You're trying to address the point. You're not trying to address the person.
Right.
And so bulverism, he just made up this thing.
He's the dragnet of philosophy.
Yeah, it's reductionism.
Yeah. That's a brief biographical sketch. So much more can be said about the man, but we kind of need to land the plane here. And what we wanted to do before we get into content is kind of do a brief nod to what he's written. And Maddie, this is really your territory because you handle a lot of this in C.S. Lewis and Friends. So what do we got? You want to start with fiction? You want to start with nonfiction?
Sure.
Where are we going?
Sure. Well, let's start with fiction because that's what he's probably most known for. He writes actually the Space Trilogy first.
Yeah.
Which is really
stuns me. Mm-hmm. Yeah, you would think they would be inverted because of how technical.
Yep. So the really cool things about the Space Trilogy is he takes medieval ideas and turns them into something that is what we would call sci-fi, which is really interesting to me.
Yeah, I just read an essay on this. So the two people undergirding Space Trilogy, we talked about McDonald, but then what he does is he takes Jules Verne intentionally and he gives it a purpose. Like, he writes that he had Jules Verne in mind when he wrote the Space Trilogy, and I think that's
the
great.
The fact that I didn't catch on to that when I read it probably means...
You need to read more fiction.
Okay.
Yeah.
I feel so ashamed.
But that's the beautiful thing about the way that Lewis and Tolkien thought about story, is that the more that you read, the more that you understand the books that you love. And the more well-read you can be, the more developed your stories can be. So Space Trilogy, amazing. The meanings of language, of life, of human life, the fight against good and evil in Perelandra. What does the hidden spiritual warfare play out? What does that imaginative mind of C.S. Lewis think about the imaginative mind that way in that hideous strength? The heart of God for man is really put out in Space Trilogy. So really cool things that way. His most famous works is what I introduce our students to in C.S. Lewis and Friends. They actually get to read Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe
as a textbook.
As a textbook, which is amazing to me. I love that. Pastor Munfrum does that. And that's amazing. The story of atonement is so very clear in that one. The one I actually teach is Prince Caspian for a couple reasons. I first introduced them to this idea of Christian fantasy literature through McDonald's. So we read The Princess and the Goblin first and get these ideas of introducing what a Christian author can do by introducing this idea of the mythical, the magical, the unseen world into this reality that we experience in the real life. How can the Christian imagination be benefited by a fanciful story, a fairy tale? So really cool. Of course, the Pevensies are introduced in, again, in Prince Caspian, and including those themes in Princess and the Goblin of faith being something that is both felt and actually a real thing, and something that you have to do even when the good things that you do, even when you cannot see, having faith even when you cannot see it. And
Disney
that's really
missed
good.
That one, didn't they?
Yeah. Disney misses a lot of really good stories. But yeah, that one for sure. And then some other works of fiction that Lewis just is brilliant in very famous. What am I thinking of? The letters. Screwtape Letters.
Oh, yeah.
And so we paraphrase, take snippets out of that one, and then also end up with Till We Have Faces, which is the last. That one was actually written, one of his only fiction books actually written for adults. And that one takes the myth, the Greek myth of Psyche and Cupid, and turns it into this philosophy of ordered loves and what does it mean to actually love. Fantastic book. It's good. Highly recommend.
If you do apologetics, you almost forget that Screwtape is fiction.
Yeah. Oh yeah. It's so true. Because
In my mind, it's a theology book. It's amazing. Like, you said Screwtape, I was like, oh yeah. That's fiction. That's right. Yeah, it's totally fiction. But where do you stand on the Order of Narnia?
Okay. So I was introduced when I was a child. My mom read them out loud to me. Highly recommend. Read to your kids.
Oh,
read them out loud
absolutely.
To your kids. Get the cool ones with the pictures.
And do the voices.
Do the voices. Yes, my mom, Wendy Grevin, fantastic voices. And we read them in the chronological order. So we started with Magician's Nephew.
Okay. So there it is. Yeah.
Yeah.
I don't know. Am I supposed to have an opinion on this?
If you're a fan, you automatically do. So the two arguments are the publication order, which goes Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe, Caspian, Don Treader, Silver Chair, Magician's Nephew, Horse and His Boy, and Last Battle. And then chronological starts with the...
I got it in one volume. My wife got... because I'm not really a fiction guy. Shocker, right? Okay, but I wish I would... So my wife got me, shortly after marriage, the Chronicles of Narnia in one volume.
Mm.
Yep.
Knowing that I'm OCD, I can't stop.
So once you begin, you have to finish.
That's right. And there's really no problem with the Chronicles of Narnia. They're page turners.
Well, you can read Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe, like, hour and a half.
Yeah.
They're not that long.
No, they're not that long, and they are real pastry.
They're easy to read.
Silver Chair.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
That's ridiculous. I don't know how you would ever put that into movie form. The BBC did it, but
which is we're grateful that it hasn't been yet.
Yeah, I mean, it's, like, it's just fantastic. It's like it's a little bit Screw Tape Letters.
Yeah.
Content of, you know, the way Satan lies to us.
Yes, and the this reality of the world lies to you about this unseen reality of the spiritual world.
Yep.
And I think that that's really, Lewis comes back to this again and again, but the Silver Chair is so, so vital in that conversation when they're in the depths, when darkness is all you can see, are you going to believe in the sun?
Yeah.
And of course, capital sun is implied, of course. There.
Yeah. Yeah. And what was the name of your vehicle?
Oh yeah, so I had a Jeep Grand Cherokee.
Did you
and it
really?
Was Reepa Jeep is
no
what
way!
I would call it.
Yes! That's crazy.
I think Reepa Jeep is my favorite
he's
character.
So good.
And he's French in my voice. He's like he's like a swashbuckling.
Oh, absolutely.
He's a mouseketeer.
Yes.
You see what I do? But yeah, it's do that. I teach so that The Magician's Nephew, I think, is one of the most important works of fiction ever written.
That's really
and
good.
Every time I read it, when you read Aslan creating Narnia,
speaking life, yeah,
singing life,
yeah.
That's
singing,
I get
yes.
goosebumps even thinking
yeah.
about it. It's
yeah,
so
same.
Beautiful,
same.
And that's where we go back to that sanctified imagination.
Yep.
It's just like you realize God speaking in song.
Yep.
That's a real thing that C.S. Lewis conceived of.
Okay, but how does he write that? That's the author part of it.
Yeah,
this stuff. Yeah, we could try to tell that. It's not going to do the goosebump thing. Somehow you can hear the singing.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
The way he writes. It's like Vin Scully doing a baseball game.
Yeah, he's brilliant, but that's mm-hmm. what it is. I'm going to call an audible at this time. I think we've wrapped this up. This is a good place to stop. We're going to start the next episode talking about his works of nonfiction leading into his theology and philosophy. So,
gotcha.
Thanks, guys.
Thank you.